I was in the midst of a shift, a transformation, but like a driver sitting at the wheel with the keys in my hand, I didn't always have the strength to lift the key to the ignition and turn over the engine. Some days, I got the car running but remained in park or neutral because I didn't have the strength to shift gears to drive. There was so much for me to process. So many wrong turns and potential hazards on the road ahead that I didn't know where to begin. That was an excerpt from the book, Sit Down to Rise Up, How Radical Self-Care Can Change the World, written by the amazing author, Shelley Tigelsky. She's a Florida meditation teacher and mom who founded the global grassroots mutual aid organization called Pandemic Love. Her work has been featured by over 100 media outlets, including CNN Heroes, The Kelly Clarkson Show, one of my favorites, CBS This Morning, and even The New York Times, as well as The Washington Post. She's a trauma mindfulness teacher and a Garrison Institute fellow. She has even been called one of the 12 powerful women of the mindfulness movement by mindful.org. And she teaches self-care and resilience at organizations around the world. She's joining us on today's episode to share with us her story about being kidnapped at the age of 2, her growth and inner journey through being temporarily blind, and ultimately this amazing book, which I have devoured before this interview. And let me tell you, I've done a lot of reading in the past month or so because one of my favorite yearly events is going down right now, and that is the Miami Book Fair. Ever since I was in college, I've been fascinated by the Miami Book Fair, the new authors, as well as renowned names that all come to chat in a room openly about their books right there in front of you. And when I started radio about 10 years ago, I worked with Radio Disney, and I was the host of the Kids Concern Show, where I interviewed a ton of amazing community and national leaders on topics that are relevant to families, topics relevant to well-being. Surprise, it's literally what I still talk about today. And as soon as I could manage it, I used my super cool Mickey Mouse credentials to find my way into the book fair and bring my favorite authors onto the show. Also to get free copies of the books because, you know, this addiction to reading can get a little expensive. And this year, Shelley is just one of the many authors from around the world participating in the Miami Book Fair. This is the nation's largest gathering of writers sharing their work, their thoughts, their new ideas with readers of all ages. And I love this Miami Book Fair. You can experience it from anywhere because they have the in-person gatherings here in Miami, but you can also check out all of the virtual gatherings. If you're interested, book nerds unite. Visit miamibookfair.com to discover so many more amazing authors that are being featured this year. But before we get started with Shelley's interview to talk all about her book, Sit Down to Rise Up, I have to tell you that I'm really looking forward to 2022. I know we haven't wrapped up 2021 just yet, but I'm excited because you and I can start 2022 together. Yes. Together. You and me, queen. I have temporarily reopened the doors to my 90-day transformational coaching program called the 3Rs system, where you and I can work together to create that custom blueprint for your success with less stress in this next chapter of your life. The program has one-on-one coaching directly with me, just you and I. It also has group coaching sessions where I'm going to give you tools to remove false beliefs that are holding you back from creating your dream life, tools to create mindset shifts so that you feel more empowered. And we're also going to work on some very effective neuroplasticity tricks that train your brain to work for you. That's just a glimpse at everything that we dive into during our 90 days together in the 3R system. You're going to love this program. If you are pivoting in life or in business right now, if you're really ready to step into your power, no BS, no excuses, all right? I got to say that. If that's your case, you deserve the customized support to help you go into this next chapter of your life with clarity, confidence, and with courage. And I want to help. So check the show notes for the link to see how you can save your seat in the launch of the 3R system, or just head on over to ggdiaz.com and click 3R system at the top of the page. This is Chats with Gigi, a podcast for women who are ready to step into their power, get unstuck, and create more freedom in all areas of life. I'm your host, Gigi Diaz, certified life and business coach, media personality, and multi-passionate entrepreneur. I've helped hundreds of women find the necessary clarity, confidence, and courage to build their dream life and achieve success with less stress. If you're seeking weekly motivation, practical and spiritual advice, and tangible resources to scale in life and in business, then you're in the right place. Are you ready? Here we go. All right. I have been really looking forward to this conversation with you, Shelly, because I devoured your book and it was just amazing. Thank you so much for being here and talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this platform.
Yeah. So, okay. First, break down for me what inspired you to write this book. This is your first book. It is amazing. Sit Down to Rise Up, How Radical Self-Care Can Change the World. And without giving too much away about the book, even though I literally could sit here and read this book page by page, and I think people will just listen to all of it. It's amazing. But, you know, without giving it away, because we do want people to sit with it themselves. What was the trigger for this book?
You know, I wasn't someone who ever thought I would write a book or that I would have necessarily what to share to write a book. Like, I did not think that that was going to be the case. But when I started to teach meditation in my local community on the beach in South Florida, and that community started to grow, and I started to feel more vulnerable and or comfortable, I should say, in my vulnerability, I started to share all sorts of stories, personal stories that, you know, were really deep wounds, like from grief and loss to, you know, divorce, trauma, miscarriages, et cetera. And as I started to share these stories, we started to connect more as a community because people came forth with their stories and it started to really weave this like safe space. So the original premise of the book was really, built around that sort of, how do I share stories that can encourage people to form community, be more vulnerable, feel more comfortable in creating safe spaces for each other. And what's really interesting is that I sold the book proposal prior to the pandemic. Many people thought like I started to write the book during the pandemic, but I sold the proposal with a completely different idea of what the book was going to be. And it really started to expand beyond the original concept as I became more involved in you know, an organization in mutual aid, an organization called Pandemic of Love, which I founded in March of 2020. And it really started to sort of write itself because I realized that, you know, community really has to rely on self-care. And we need to redefine what self-care actually means and kind of take it back from where it's been hijacked from, which is really, you know, the industrial wellness complex of self-care being bath bombs and chai lattes and, you know, mud masks. And it's really, that's not what it is. And the self really is not an individualistic pursuit as well. It's really communal. We are so interconnected. And so really, you know, the inspiration started to snowball, I think, during the pandemic. So it was a journey for sure. The end, the finished product is not what I started out with on paper, for sure.
I think it's so funny you should say that, because is the finished product of anything ever what we start with?
It's not. But I think that, well, for some people, it's because it's not, you know, the product is not coming along to their specifications or to the attachments of what they think it's going to be like, they just give up and quit. And they say, mm-hmm. well, it's not working out, so I'm just going to quit. And I think that the beauty really lies in the flexibility to be able to say, well, it's not going this way, so how do I pivot? Or how do I sort of circumvent this or go around it? Or what is this lesson in this obstacle that's before me? And I think that's the mother of all invention, really, you know, and that's where all the lessons are, where all the juice is.
I love that. So you've touched on a few things that I definitely want to dive deeper into, such as your meditation practice. And there's this really beautiful picture in the book that starts with when you began meditating at the beach. And then, mm-hmm. you know, just a few years later, you've got this entire, it's a literal mob of people sitting on the beach with you, just meditating, yeah. just sitting there connecting to the self. So we will dive into that and your concept of self-care and what a village is. But I think what you just mentioned right now in regards to your personal growth and your community begins with self-care, begins with looking inward. And there's something that you say in your book that I found amazing. It's one of the many things that I highlighted. You say, to think that any individual could be completely independent is laughable. There's no such thing as true independence. And you say that when it, you know, when you're talking about everything it took just to put your book together. So
yeah.
can you dive a little deeper into how that journey inward is in fact what helps us to create the community, the connections, and the support that we are all in so much need of right now?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, especially in this kind of social media world that we live in, people really only get to see the highlight reels, but they don't really get to see all that goes into the creation of an idea or a thought or, you know, even just, believe it or not, like a meme that you're looking at and that you're pressing like, think about the fact that somebody had to think about it, create it. Somebody had to create that person. Somebody had to create the software, or many people had to create the software and the ability for that person to do that. And they had to go to school and they had teachers and they had, you know, and you start to kind of extrapolate this out. And I do this exercise often, you know, when I'm about to sit down and eat a meal. It's not a formalized practice of like saying grace or a prayer, but in a way, I guess it is like a prayer, right? I look at my plate and I think, how many hands have touched this? And not just like physically, like literally touch just, you know, the spinach on my plate, but really like the generations that had to precede it, and just indirectly contribute to this lettuce or this spinach or whatever it is that I'm about to ingest. Right. And I really just take a moment to sort of reflect on that and think about the fact that really a lot of times we think that the self ends with this human form, this physical body. And the reality is that it's not the case. You know, there is no self. There is no I that we speak of. There's just this perception of what the I is. But essentially, you know, every single thing that we do creates a chain reaction, some that are known to us and some that are not known to us. And in the book, I call them, you know, ripples or you know, circles of influence that we have that we're aware of and that we're unaware of. And the more we become conscious to all the contributors into our makeup and the self that we kind of define as ourselves, the more that we have the ability to really understand also the inverse of that, like how we can affect other people as well. And so when we have that awareness, that self-awareness, no pun intended there, but really the self-awareness, we, you know, we really start to feel like we have an inherent connection and also more obligation, not just to other people in our lives that we know, but to all sentient beings who are known and unknown to us, who came before us and who will come, you know, after us, after we're long gone. And that really starts to shift the perspective of how we show up in life. You know, how we show up for ourselves, how we show up for other people, and what we believe could be possible in terms of creating these paradigm shifts and these new systems that we're trying to build to replace the systems that are broken or that are not working in our current cultures and societies that we're living in.
And what would be a concrete example of how we can connect that inner work, that inner discovery, that inner journey in a beautiful way to affect the outer world?
Well, one of the concrete examples that I give in my book is creating a formalized community of care. So I, you know, I'm a very big fan, as you know, of mutual aid and of the idea that we can create redistribution of wealth within our communities. And when I say wealth, I mean it loosely. I don't mean like money per se. Yes, money also, but you know, people suffer from things like time poverty and energy poverty and, you know, all of these other afflictions and things that we need individually. But all of us also have, regardless of our socioeconomic status, something that we can offer in this world and to our communities. And so a really tangible way that we can show up for each other is to actually start formalizing that in very small, kind of hyper-local ways, rather than just, you know, doing it after there's a natural disaster or after, you know, there's a pandemic that happens, you know, when we start to show up for people or when there's a tragedy, like a 9/11 type tragedy, you know, when people suddenly are like, I want to be a helper. How can I help? What can I do? And then suddenly we kind of, and we've seen this now in the last, you know, 19 months where, you know, as soon as things started to open up in certain communities, people started going back to their quote unquote normal lives. But many people don't have that privilege or luxury to go back to their normal lives. And so I talk a lot of in the book about how we need to create formalized self-care plans for ourselves, like the individual self that we believe that we are. And then we need to share those plans with other people who have done the same thing, so that we could start to remove obstacles for each other. We could start to really truly create equity and create these like redistributions of wealth that create safety nets within our community. And it's not very hard to do because it happens naturally again after these like disasters, and then it ultimately goes away. And my point in the book really is that creating communities of care doesn't need to go away. It's something that should always exist. It sort of started to go away because it was like inherent to the fabric of our societies pre the industrial age, pre the technological revolution, when we really knew our neighbors. You know, we know about this magical time period that our grandparents told us about called back in the day. And, you know, they talk about back in the day, you know, everybody knew their neighbors' names, but they knew what was going on in their lives. Like they knew that somebody had mental health issues or somebody just experienced loss or they lost their job or that they were sick. And when that happened, the community surrounded them with everything that they needed to be able to get back on their feet or get well again, or feel like, you know, that they were not alone and that they had this like village surrounding them. We sort of need to get back to that mentality, I think. I know we need to get back to this if we're actually going to survive and thrive in this world, this daunting world that we're living in and facing today.
Where do you think that disconnection happened, Shelly? Where do you think was the moment when we went from having that village, from knowing our neighbors' names, from caring about what was going on in their lives and having the strength to be vulnerable, to share with them what was going on in yeah. our lives? When did that stop? Where did we lose that, do you think?
Well, I think that we lost that when we started to, a couple things happened, right? The Industrial Revolution happened. And then in order to create efficiencies, we started to move towards globalization. We started to move from sort of these hyper-local connections that we had to this like wider, our aperture suddenly widened. And so there's some inherently good things about globalization, of course. But there's also some things that were sort of left behind. So I think that, you know, just forming kind of intimate connections got left behind. I think certainly the advent of technology and this sense of being connected, right, of having 5,000 friends on Facebook has also really led to that, because that's an illusion. That's not like real. You know, there's maybe some elements of connection, but at the end of the day, not so much. And I also think that, you know, the fact that we have started to evolve away from organized religion, which I'm not a big fan of, by the way, like I'm not a part of like any type of organized religion. Culturally, I was raised as a Jew, but, you know, I don't really identify as, you know, or go to synagogue or do anything ritualistic. But I do think that you know, while there were many things that were certainly prohibitive and restrictive and certainly also, you know, atrocious about what organized religion has done over the history of the world and in time, there were also some inherent things that we talk about, like as in community, where people really felt like they were part of this like larger group of people that, you know, inherently were there to take care of each other. And so I think like all of these things, this convergence of all of these things over decades, over generations, has sort of created this shift away from local communities and has made it more difficult for people to feel like they have a safety net and feel like they are in a position where they can ask for help and feel seen and heard, you know? And I think we have an opportunity to get back to that now because we are going through this, I think, conscious awakening that is just happening, you know, just naturally happening, where people are sort of really just reaching back for that state of simplicity, reaching back for a state of connection, because ultimately, you know, that is the natural state that human beings thrive in. Not just human beings, all sentient beings, right? When we think about how ecosystems thrive, we look at their coexistence and their ability to lean on each other, right? Whether it's a coral reef ecosystem where there's an anemone and a clownfish, which is something that most people, especially those with kids, would be familiar with that analogy. But, you know, I think we oftentimes have been told that really when we think about even Darwinian theory in its simplest form, we automatically default to, oh, survival of the fittest, you know? So it's really survival of the fittest when you look at it from a social biological perspective and you think about, oh, you know, it's very capitalistic in a sense, right? It's just like, may the best man win or may the best human win. And best is subjective, right? It's a subjective mm-hmm. term. But really, we sort of left behind all these other beautiful ideas that come out of Darwinian theory, which is that the ecosystems that rely on each other, the species that coexist, don't just survive, but they actually thrive. And I think that's where we're starting to hopefully start to move towards again and to evolve to once again to recognize that we're in our best. We're at our best individually when we are at our best collectively and vice versa. Like when we heal ourselves, we heal others. When others heal themselves, they heal us. And it's just this beautiful symbiotic nature to it. And I say in the book, really, and which is really the premise of the whole book, which is that, you know, the best version of the world has to start with the best version of ourselves.
Mm. I love that. And going back to the book, you open with such a powerful memory, and it is of you getting kidnapped when you were 2 years old and being rescued by a complete stranger. But you also share how you were almost oblivious to the whole thing as it was happening, right? How did that experience affect your life as an adult when you look back to that? And how does it continue to influence your work today?
Well, in the book, I share that I don't really remember the incident at all. I only remember it as it was being told to me growing up and told to other people, really as like a great cocktail reception or dinner party story, you know, shock value. But, you know, the story was always really centered around my mother, who had to go through this experience when I was taken out of a DMV here in New York City in Brooklyn. And I just was picked up by two strangers and they walked out with me. And a woman that was sitting in the waiting room who saw me come in with my mother and realized something was wrong, made a decision in that moment to follow these individuals for several city blocks and see kind of where they were going so she could come back and alert my mother. And, you know, when the story was told, oftentimes in my childhood, people would immediately, of course, have empathy for my mother. Oh, that's so terrible. I can't believe you went through that. And then they would also have sympathy for me, like, wow, that must have been really traumatic for you. And that's awful. But very few people actually centered and focused on this Good Samaritan, as I call her in the book, this woman who in the moment of impact or, you know, the moment where she saw that something was wrong, she had many options available to her, right? She could have done nothing, which is actually a choice. People often think that doing nothing is not a choice, but it is an active decision. She could have run to get my mother, which seemed like a safer choice for her. But instead, she chose the option that was the least safe for her, right? Because there were so many unknowns. And in that moment, she just chose to follow these individuals. She didn't know where they were going or if they were armed or if they were getting in a car or what have you. And she just decided to risk her life, really, potentially, to save mine. And that was something that I really centered on for a long time in my life. I started to think about, would I have made the same decision? And for many years, I didn't really think the answer would be yes, because I just thought, well, I can't be that good Samaritan because I'm broken and I've got a lot of issues and, I'm not brave enough to do something like that. And the reality is that, you know, this experience or the retelling of this experience for me and my focus on the Good Samaritan started to make me realize that, like, really, we all have that ability and capability just woven into the fabric of who we are. And that's really our God-given sense of agency that we have, right? Some people are aware of that agency. Some people are totally walking through life unaware of it. But I think at the moment when we really become awakened to that agency and our capability to sort of wield it, then suddenly, you know, we realize that we are much more empowered to create these shifts in the world that we want to see than we think we are able to. So that has stayed with me. And really this woman who my family lost touch with, because this happened back in the 1970s, you know, there was much more difficult to keep in touch with people as you were moving around and they were moving around. So I don't know her. I never had a chance to really like personally reconnect with her, thank her. If she's still alive, maybe I keep saying to myself, oh, maybe she's, you know, I've kind of put it out in the universe. Maybe somebody will read the book and say, you told me this story before, like this might be you, you know, you should get in touch with the author. So who knows what may happen. But yeah, I you know, it, that story has definitely shaped up and planted a seed in me that continues to proliferate today.
And I think it connects back to the importance of showing up, which is a really, really powerful theme in this book, right? To just show up for yourself, to show up for others. How has showing up shaped your success, right? And more importantly, how have you trained yourself or pushed yourself to show up in the times when it is not easy to show up? Because there are times when it's like, yeah, I want to do this. I planned for this. I prepared for this, right? So of course I'm going to show up. Not in those times. Those are the easy times. In the times when it's like, what in the hell is going on right now? And I can't deal. How do you show up then? And then use that power to show up for others too.
Well, I don't think I ever get to the default mode at this point after 20 plus years of meditation. Practice, you know, I never get to the point where I'm like, I can't deal. I always know I can deal. I always know that I have the tools to deal with whatever comes my way. And there's been some pretty harrowing things that have come my way, not just in the last few years, but, you know, throughout my life. And so knowing that, first of all, is of great comfort, knowing that I am able and capable of dealing with anything in a healthy way is really important. That doesn't mean that it absolves me of having these like human reactions to things and that I sort of, you know, deny myself the ability to move through things that are even incredibly difficult and intense. The point of meditation is, and I often tell people this, is not to make you more comfortable in life. It's to actually allow you to sit with discomfort. In a way that, you know, it doesn't feel as heavy, right? It gives you the tools to deal with your discomfort. And so when things are happening in the world or personally in my life, and you're like, what is going on? You know, how can I deal with this? I sit with it. I literally sit with my feelings. I label what it is that I'm going through. What am I feeling? What are my reactions? What's coming up for me? And in times, you know, it could be great sadness. And there's been times, especially in the last election cycles, you know, where it's outrage. And I sit with that. And then I think to myself, okay, now that I know what I'm feeling, let me tend to myself, let me nurture myself. And I do that. And then I move beyond that. You know, I move to a place where in positive psychology terms, it's called the tend and befriend, but I call it empathy action, where I, you know, think about, okay, this is what I'm feeling. And what am I going to do about it? What tangible way can I respond to the way that I am feeling, not just for myself, but for others, especially if it's something that is affecting other people. And the next question that immediately comes up for me is, and how do I come from a place of love? So what am I going to do about this thing that is causing me great outrage or angst or sadness? And how am I going to come from a place of love when I do this thing? And so that ultimately always leads me to interesting spaces, you know, especially in the last 6-7 years of my life. You know, it led me to the beach. It led me to form a political action group in South Florida. It led me to, you know, the Women's March and to a lot of the social justice work that I have been doing and engaged in the last 5 years. And it ultimately led me to Pandemic of Love as well.
Here's the thing. We've been taught to believe that being an entrepreneur has to be hard and that hiring help is unaffordable for new businesses. But these beliefs are false and they keep you from being able to scale and grow. Think about this. How much more money would your business make if you hired a lead generation expert? This is someone whose sole job is to find you potential clients. It's a position that pretty much pays for itself. Entrepreneurs succeed faster when they work on their business, not in their business. And I really wish I had learned that 18 years ago. So look, if you're ready to scale your business, if you're ready to grow, you got to contact Staffy. That's where I hire my assistants from. And since you're coming from my show, they're going to give you 2 free weeks. Go to getstaffy.com/GG to get started with 2 free weeks of professional support for your business. That's getstaffy.com/GG and get started today. I love that. I love that just, you know, the going back to how it starts within, you know, how it starts with just taking pause, or like you say in the book, sit down to rise up. It's perfect. And now there is something that I want to touch upon because it's also very close to my heart and what I do with my coaching organization, Seizing Happy. And that is the concept of positive thinking, right? It feels like so many people out there are trying to lead others or mm-hmm. use themselves, you know, the thought of like, you know, just think positively and everything is going to be okay. Like, oh, just stay positive and it's going to be fine. Or, oh, you know, if you just keep a positive mindset. And I have a huge issue with that just because I believe that while you do have to be in a state of seizing happy, which is, you know, the name of my company is you deserve to be in a state of looking for your happiness, right? Like, and that's always going to be a changing term for you. Your happiness in your 20s is different than your happiness in your 30s than it is, you know, your happiness as a mom than it is your happiness as a wife, right? You deserve to be in a state of looking for that. But you right. also have to dive deep into the moments when you A, don't know what your happiness is in that season of your life, which happens, or B, aren't feeling the happiness, right? Like you have to be able to say, I don't feel well right now. And you can't just mask it with a meme or with,
yeah.
you know, a happy song or a dance, right? Or a phone call or happy hour. You have to sit there with that sadness, with that darkness, with that brokenness and say, all right, I am feeling this hurt right now. I am feeling this void right now. And I deserve to be in a state of seizing happy. But in order to be seizing happy, you have to look at what the problem is. You can't just put the Band-Aid of positive thinking on it, right? So tell me your feeling. I know you have issue with that mantra of just like positive thinking. What does that mean to you?
Well, first of all, I think that when you say that to certain, because I work in spaces with a lot of traumatized people, I work with refugee aid workers. I work with refugees. I work with individuals who have experienced possibly the worst thing that they could experience, losing their children to gun violence in this country, which is a really, you know, harrowing and unfortunately ongoing experience. I deal with communities affected by mass shootings, you know, as a whole. And so when I deal with individuals going through trauma, saying to them, like, good vibes only, you know, like, have, you know, you should just be happy. Here are the five ways you can be happy. It's discounting their experience of trauma. Mm-hmm. And it also kind of oversimplifies, I think, this human experience. And I really think that in order to honestly feel rich, true happiness, we have to be willing to also feel deep grief and sadness. Because like light can't exist without darkness. We know this. And that's really true in terms of like our whole emotional spectrum. I don't believe that to really be fully human, that we have good or bad emotions. Being sad is not a bad emotion. That's the stigma that has been told to us by this westernized culture. But if you really go back to like Eastern philosophy, you know, it's the whole of the emotions wheel, right? If you look up the emotions wheel, you can Google it. You could see that it is this beautiful, colorful wheel that helps us fully identify one of over the 33,000 emotions that we can feel throughout our day. And so we should allow ourselves to feel all of that, you know, we should allow ourselves to feel deeply and label it. And so I'm a big fan of naming it to tame it, you know, labeling it. What am I feeling at this moment? And sometimes I don't have the answers. I don't have the words to express exactly what I'm feeling this moment. But the longer I sit with it, the more it becomes clear. You know, the mind has this beautiful way of sort of getting loud the quieter that you get. And it's really great if you're willing to listen to create this notion of self-awareness. So I do have a problem with, you know, with just not necessarily the understanding that, yes, of course, if you keep a gratitude journal and you say what you're grateful for, even in the most harrowing times, and you're able to just be grateful for three things, you know, in your life, you know, that's a beautiful practice. I love that. I love that. But that doesn't mean that just because you're grateful for those three things that you should also not understand that this thing happened to me and it sucks, you know? You know, and that's really the key is like, I could be grateful for so many things on a daily basis, but that doesn't discount that or make it less valid that this other really sucky thing happened to me today. Right. So I think that, when we kind of like allow people to feel validated in whatever feelings they're feeling, whether they're happy or sad, I think that that's when we're going to be able to really kind of move ahead in a much healthier way culturally.
And I think it's making room for that duality is important too, which is another thing that you mention in the book. Yeah. Is you can be grateful for the beautiful things in your life. And you can also just be really, really sad about, or really yeah. angry, or really, you know, lost, you know, and still feel gratitude and still smile. You can be grieving and still laugh, you know, yeah. and making room for that. We don't necessarily have to box ourselves in I'm right. either happy or sad, or I'm either this or that. And that's one experience that you share in the book as well about a moments when, let me see if I remember, I know I wrote it on, I have your book in front of me right now. And I'm like, of all the things that I've written down, which one do I want to ask her next? But the moment when somebody's comment that they didn't even remember years down the line opened the door for you to give yourself permission to be Jewish, but also explore meditation and explore Buddhist practices and not feel like, well, some part of my identity is being betrayed, or some part of, you know, the beliefs yeah. that my parents gave to me are being shut down right. because I'm curious. Can we dive into that? Because I feel like our inability to embrace the duality of all the different things that we can be and still be something else is really mm-hmm. keeping us from growth. It's keeping us from tapping into our yeah. potential.
100%. Yeah. I do talk a lot about, and that's like a very important Buddhist like tenet, you know, tenet in Buddhism is that you can hold two truths in duality, right? It's, we live very much in this sort of like either or world, but it's not. The world we need to be living in is there's truth to this and there's also truth to this. So how do we kind of like create this like through line? What's the commonality? And a lot of times, even things that you think are so opposed to each other, right? Like is in this political, very highly politicized environment that we're living in right now, you know, that we're going through, you think like there's what could possibly a person who is pro-choice and pro-life have in common, right? They're never going to agree on anything. But okay, let's try to boil it down to we value life. Can we agree on that? Can we agree on the fact that we value life? Maybe our definitions of how we're valuing it are different, you know, but then can we sort of start removing these different types of conditionings that we have that are gifted to us without our knowing sometimes, you know, throughout our life, what we're born into, the culture that we're raised in, the religion that we're raised in, the color of our skin. We have all these like sort of conditionings that are, and these stories that are told to us that we are just sort of born into, and that we believe that this must be true, and that it is not only the truth, but that it can't also, therefore this other thing cannot be true. Mm. And so, yeah, when I, you know, wanted to start practicing meditation, which again, I, in my mind, this was back in the late 90s, you know, I really never met a Buddhist in my life, you know, in where I was growing up. And I honestly thought meditation was only for Buddhists. And that was, you know, this was pre-mindfulness coloring books in the supermarkets. This was pre all of that. So there wasn't really a lot of accessibility to Buddhism beyond like going to like a center for TM or like, you know, like finding actually a Buddhist center or studying about it like in college. And so when I met my core teacher, Sharon Salzberg, and she told me that, you know, that I could essentially be a Buju or a Jubu, you know, or be whatever I wanted to be and kind of hold both truths in duality, that sort of flipped open my world and like gave me all of these insane possibilities. But it also, you know, in a really tangible way, and I talk about this in the book as well, you know, growing up as a Jew that was born in Israel, in Jerusalem. And, you know, I've been, and I still to this day really struggles with like, what does it mean to be Israeli? Like, you know, and what does the word Israel mean? And, you know, does that automatically make me a Zionist because I was born in Israel? And like, could Judaism exist beyond that? You know, so I have all these like existential, like big grappling questions that I've been working through, especially over the last decade. But when we go to Israel, you know, when we go to Palestine, when we go to Jerusalem, especially, I lead a retreat there every year with David G. And it's a 10-day retreat. And we make sure that we have both an Israeli guide who is Jewish, and we have a Palestinian guide who is Muslim. And that way we get to hear both narratives. So when the Jewish guide is talking about, you know, Israeli independence in 1948, the Palestinian guide is talking about al-Nakba, the catastrophe, the great catastrophe in 1948. And we get to sort of hear these like dual narratives in parallel. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. It's that, you know, we get to basically understand that there are these two sort of like stories and conditionings that are essentially being viewed in black and white. And it's way more complex than that, you know, and that we, in order to survive, we have to be willing to hold both and live in the gray areas.
I love that. And yeah, and there's just so much that we can continue to dive into in these conversations about allowing space, right, for ourselves, allowing space for others, and understanding that, you know, we don't, just like how you said it right now, like our ability to thrive comes from living in that gray area, from, you know, allowing all of the things to be and accepting all of the truths that surround us, right? And doing that mm-hmm. with love, because right. It's easy to say, well, the way I lived it is the way I see it is the way I was brought up. So you must be wrong. But that's not necessarily the case, because their truth and their the way in which that other person lived it and experienced it and was taught it is also factual. It's just looked at from a different lens based on, you know, a different culture, a different time, a different experience of the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly so.
Yeah. And I think something that's also really beautiful, specifically in that experience with you and Sharon, it was not just how she triggered your ability to open the doors to the duality of, yes, I can be Jewish and I can also explore Buddhism and meditation, but that came from, that was the result of her just holding space for you when you said, can I ask you something? And her nurse, we'll talk about it after the class, or we'll do it later. Yeah, sure. Whatever. You know what I mean? Like just pausing for you too, and allowing you to ask and allowing you to be curious and answering it with love, right? Like, I feel like that's also so powerful. And for us to be able to show up in that way and not let the hurried, I got to be here by a certain time, or this is what I need to do next, or I'm too caught up in my own life and my own shit, right? To pause for someone else and say, what's your question? How can I help you with that?
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with you for sure.
I love that. What is your ultimate goal for Sit Down and Rise Up?
I don't live my life centered around goals. I live my life centered around intentions. So I don't have a goal. My intention is that this book finds its way into the hands of the people that need to read it the most, and that it inspires people to be of service and to live in community and to understand how interconnected we are and to do something about it.
I got to tell you, I've read a lot of books in the past month or so, and this is definitely one of my favorites. So thank you for taking so much of your life and putting it on paper for us, because it's really been a joy to sit down with this book. Where can we buy Sit Down and Rise Up? Sit Down to Rise Up.
You can go to and support your local bookstores by going to bookshop.org. And even if the book says it's on pre-order or waitlist me, just go ahead and order it. And I promise you that eventually the books will get into, they're the currently finally in the warehouse, in the distributor's warehouse. So I know they're on their way to the bookstores right now, and that they're on their way to Amazon's warehouse as well. So you can go to Amazon, but you could also support your local bookshop, which is always preferable. In the next couple of weeks, I'm not really sure the timing of when this podcast is going to air, but definitely by mid-November, the book itself will be in bookstores as well. And you'll be able to pick up a physical copy in person. So any of those things. And then it's also available on Kindle. And I also recorded it myself. So it's my voice reading the book, and that's available on Audible.
Thank you so much, Shelley, for being on the show with us today. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it so much.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Chats with Gigi. If you enjoyed the show, let me know by leaving a review on iTunes. This way, I can keep bringing you more of what you love. If you don't follow me yet, let's connect. You can find me as Gigi Diaz Live on all social media platforms, or head over to my website at gigidiaz.com. I can't wait to chat with you again in the next episode. Until then, I'll be sending lots of love and light your way.